Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
The Science of Sport podcast with sports editor Mike Finch and sports scientist Professor Ross Tucker.
So welcome to another episode of The Science of Sports. My name is Mike Finch and I'm here with Professor Ross Tucker and our mediator. Well, it's not really a mediator, more of an organizer of our discourse channel, Gareth Davies, who's been with us a couple of times already in the last couple of months. And today we're going to be talking about some of the many subjects that have been raising the interest of our discourse participants. And if you want to know how to get onto discourse, then you can easily do it by just going onto our Patreon channel, which is patreon.com, and look for the Science of Sport podcast. You then just with a small donation, get involved in supporting our podcast. It's not really that much. You can do three different levels. And then once you have your Patreon membership sorted out, you can then get onto our discourse channel. All the links are there on our Patreon site. So then you can check out some of the many subjects that are happening on our discourse channel at the moment. And there are many. And we will touch on a few of them with some themes throughout the podcast today. And hopefully we will be able to bring some more discussion around them. A big thank you to all of our discourse members. I think we've got a nice, every week it kind of grows more and more, Gareth. I mean, it seems like the conversations are becoming a little bit more animated, and some of the stuff, there's a couple of agitators in there, which is kind of what you want on a discourse channel, isn't it?
I won't go as far as agitators, to be honest with you. There's differences of opinion, perhaps.
Yes.
But no, there hasn't been any real issues. I know Ross jumped in the other day to try and explain the difference, I think, between widespread and systematic doping, which was a good insight. I enjoyed that one. We're up over 500 members now. So you're getting lots of different opinions from around the world. And one thing I was saying to Ross is I love the way that there's like a cycle to the discussions, because you go to bed and of course then the other side of the world is waking up and adding their opinions, and you wake up and see a load of more. And as Ross said, it gets a bit overwhelming sometimes when you're trying to follow four threads, try to do the reading in between to find out a little bit about it. It's almost exhausting at times, but really enjoying it.
Well, I actually don't know how you guys managed to do it, because I know you both got day jobs, as have I, and I know there's a lot of stuff. And if you go onto our discourse channel, I know you're both contributing a lot to some of the discussions. So thank you for that. And for those of you who want some of the insights from both these two and the many experts, and I think that's what's important on our discourse channel, there's a lot of people in there in the very high levels of sport that are contributing towards the discussion. But you don't have to be those kind of people either. You can just have a good opinion and have an interest in sports science, and I think you'll get a lot out of that discourse channel as well. So lots to get excited about. Ross, have you what's kind of caught your eye on discourse recently? I know we're going to talk about specific subjects, but what's been your general thoughts around our discourse channel at the moment?
Yeah, there's a couple of threads that I think are interesting. There's one on the science of the taper, where someone posted about, do I really need to taper? And those of you who are listening, that's not an animal with a long snout. To taper with an E is when you modify your training in the last few weeks before a race in order to recover, because training makes you fit, but it also makes you fatigued. And the balance between the training load and the recovery is what then optimizes performance. And so that was initiated on the discourse forums. And then a number of people jumped in with some pretty technical support and thoughts and advice. Gerald is always great value. Kevin McQuaid is always great value. So that was a really good one and shows me that there's a lot of value in discourse for people who want good insights on training. And then a similar one, which I think we'll actually touch on a little bit more today, is someone who, Alasdair is the name of the person who posted about being a runner, trying to prepare for sub-3 marathons. That's a pretty good runner, who then is trying to integrate a bit of cycling and has noticed that the heart rate is so different from the cycling to the running. And then that kicks off the same kind of conversation. a lot of people then explain why that might be and what he might try and so forth. So, yeah, those two have been good because it shows me that we've got good, insightful, applied thinkers.
Mm.
And you'll get a lot of coaching value on it if you use it right, I think.
It is something that we want to do in the future around tapering because I think it is a podcast on itself. Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's quite a good, it's difficult to do that research because like what's the control group, right?
Mm.
You take a group of elite athletes or even sub-elite who've trained for 3 months, 6 months for a marathon or big cycling event, and then you try and modify the training. But those same people can never recreate that without the taper. So you're always comparing different people in a situation where the final performance, the marathon time or the cycling performance is variable anyway. And so you're trying to find a signal in quite a lot of noise.
Mm.
Difficult studies to do. But there is a bit, and it's definitely worth exploring. Even the, like a lot of you listening to this will use online apps and programs that calculate, Strava does this incidentally, it calculates your current fitness and it also calculates your chronic load. And the ratio or the difference between those is your fatigue or recovery state. So if your last 7 days are higher than your last 4 weeks, let's say, or 6 weeks, then in theory, you're loading the system. If your last 7 days are easier than the previous six, in theory, you're recovering. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, and so all these things provide those metrics. And I think it would be quite useful to explore that actually at some point.
Mm. I use that Strava fitness thing as a bit of a gauge.
Mm.
I know it's not terribly accurate, but it is a pretty good gauge about.
But the way you.
I know if I'm on 80, I'm in good shape and I'm on 60 now.
Yeah, but okay, so here's the thing about a taper is you could get to 80 simply by doing 3 weeks of really hard, like 5 days a week, 3 hours on the bike, you'll get 90.
Yeah.
And you'll be hell of a tired and you won't perform.
For sure.
So the question about the taper is, what do you need to be while recovered? Because you can get to 90 and then you've got a taper, you'll drop to 80. Or you get to 80, you drop to 70.
Mm.
Which is better, 70 fresh or 80 fatigued?
Mm. Well, there's also that recovery score. So at the end of the day, you want to be recovered and fit.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the trade-off, right? That's the balance that you're constantly trying to do with the taper. So yeah, so you can sign up if you're not already on Discourse and you can read people's thoughts on that. But we'll certainly put it on our list of subjects to discuss in more depth on the show.
A big thank you to Ross, who did our last podcast, Flying Solo, the one where he interviewed Jamie Whitfield. And I wasn't able to do it because I was actually at the Absa Cape Epic mountain bike race, so working as an announcer. But I listened to that podcast, and I'm still listening to it because I kind of listened to it, and I think, I'm missing something here. I've forgotten what he said then. I go back a bit. So I kind of listened and re-listened to the thing many times. And it really is like I know we've spoken to people in the past and I certainly think that podcast in particular made a big impression because it really is really practical and it debunks a lot of the hype around keto diets and what the reality is and based on science. It's a subject that is so emotive because there are people that are massively focused on keto and they will swear by it. And certainly they are convincing. But when you get back to the science, that podcast really does lay down the science in a very real way.
I'm glad. I was worried it might be a little bit too technical.
No, not at all.
Mechanistic. Because
not at all.
Jamie and I both love a bit of the detail, the molecular explanations. But he was very direct and I enjoyed it.
It was
and
great.
Incidentally, I'm not going to say as thanks, let's call it, for doing it, we give all our guests access to Discourse. And Jamie very kindly went beyond the call of duty and then started answering additional questions on Discourse in that discussion. So there's another little value add for you.
There we go.
Yeah.
So look back on that. That's our podcast, the one just before we did now. I'll have a look for it. It's certainly worth listening to, particularly if you're involved in endurance sport. So talking about endurance sport, let's kick off our subjects for today. And it's spring marathon season with a lot of focus on Olympic selection. And there's a couple of discussions, just having a brief wrap up of the top marathons. We had Tokyo, which Benson Kipruto from Kenya won in 2:02. Women's race was won by Sutume Kabede, the Ethiopian, in 2:15. So quick time there. Boston, a very good race to watch, as it is usual, because they don't have pace setters. And it's I love the course. And I think it's a classic racist course where you don't have, it's not that this flat out course. It's always not necessarily a fast time, but always a good race. So Sisa Lema was the Ethiopian, was the winner there in 2:06. And Helena Beery in 2:22 in the women's race. And then London, which just happened a few days ago, Alexander Mutiso, the Kenyan, 2:04.01 there. And Kenenisa Bekele was second, 41 years old, breaking the world record for the Masters. So quite amazing there. And Peres Tipchicha, the Kenyan, winning the women's race in 2:16, women's only world record there as well. So London, really the standout race in many ways of the spring marathon so far.
For the women.
For the women. And also the men to some extent.
I thought the men's race was really mediocre, but then again, I hardly watched it thanks to the BBC.
Yeah, we'll get onto that.
I mean, I don't know what happened in the men's race. For all I know, there was a Bermuda Triangle along the Thames River that swallowed half the field, but we missed it because no one thought to show it. It was unbelievable. But it was an interesting one because I didn't ever in any of the races get the impression I was seeing heavyweights race each other. I get the impression they're avoiding each other. Maybe there was definitely some tactical race selections going on. Like I know the Ethiopians tried to get themselves into different races because the feeling was that if they were all in one, only the winner would be selected for Paris. And so that the strongest Ethiopian group ended up being split between London and Boston. And so the guy who won London was training mates with Tamarat Tola, who ended up, I don't know, being swallowed by that Bermuda Triangle in London. So yeah, I didn't find it. I don't know. Is this something a bit
something about the majesty of the? Excuse me, maybe that's a bad term, but the grandiose way that London is run, it always feels like you're running through a proper big city marathon. Whereas, Boston, I guess, to some extent, is also like that lovely Boston, crowd to see along the side of the road.
Properly deep.
But there's something about London which I love, and I think I've always appreciated the way it finishes. So I guess I maybe have a bias towards London.
And the women's race, you had four women racing for a world record with 300 meters to go. So that's hard to top that. So the women's race in London was exceptional. Mm. I thought the men's race, I don't know what it was. And then in Boston, it was the same, incidentally. In Boston, Lema won that race. He was, when I started watching it just after halfway, the only question was, okay, I suppose for a while, could they catch him?
Incredible.
But he was minutes ahead.
Yeah.
The women, they were 15 together at 35K. And then the most notable thing about that race was that they ran 15:05 for 5Ks. And then they finished at 3 minutes a K as well. So Helen O'Berry ran the last 7 and a bit K at 21 minutes, which is the fastest 5K split ever in a marathon.
Yeah.
And if I had to bet on who's winning Paris, because of the nature of the course and the way that she can do that, I can't think of anyone who can finish a marathon like that. Mm. And then Tokyo was notable, I think, for where Kipchoge came, which is another subject we can get onto. I don't know what Gareth's thoughts were on overall marathon. I know he didn't watch London with me, along with me, so...
Well, I sort of watched it along with you because I messaged you to say, you know, are you watching this? And I didn't realize you were actually on the same feed as me until you said, this isn't great coverage, is it? Because there's two, at least in the UK, you can watch different feeds. So you could watch the sort of the mass participation of the runners, or you can watch the elite side. You choose to just watch the elite side with the commentary. So obviously I chose the elite side and was watching that. And I understand that it must be very difficult to actually commentate for 2 hours of a marathon and keep it interesting and fresh sort of thing for any sort of endurance events. And that's probably part of the problem with having media coverage of endurance events is to the non-real enthusiast, I suppose it can get kind of boring. But I noticed at the time, it was when there were two leaders, weren't there, in the men's race. And there were a couple of British athletes going for the qualifying times. And I understand why they were going back to the British athletes a lot. But at the time, there was a split between the two male leaders, right at the, you know, they're into the last, they're in the last mile, I think. And I said, I won't include the language I put in my message to you. And I said, a decisive move in a men's race, but we missed it because we were watching a camel. And at the time, there was a split in the race and we were watching two people dressed as a camel in the mass participation, which is fine. And as you said, that camel and like Bekele is trying to finish its 10th marathon and well worthy of the coverage. Plus it raised money, whereas Bekele did not, which is fine. And I absolutely get that most people do want to watch the fun side of the marathon, the charity, the really good stories. But when you're on the elite racing feed, it is frustrating to miss that part of the race. And like I say, I do understand why they focused on the Brits, because they focused on a couple of the female Brit finishers. But again, we were missing so much of what was actually going on in the rest of the race because they were just staying on them too long. So that was my thoughts on the London part, just the media part. I thought I'd get that bit out of the way.
I genuinely think, sorry, I don't think that whoever directed it, because you know it works in an OB van. I've also done a bit of commentary at SABC, but Mike's done more. And you know the broadcast setup. There's a director who basically calls for which shots to show. The director at London has never watched a marathon in his life or her life.
Yeah.
But based on what was happening, like, you know when things are going to happen. And even when they do, like, you've got camera on it, right? It's not like you've got to send one motorbike back and forth. There's a camera on them. So just show it as if it's live, but show what happened a minute before. That's not difficult tech. It's called a replay. And show split screens. That's not complicated tech. They had it in Boston. The whole race was basically a split screen, which makes it quite difficult because you've got to like really get close to your laptop screen or TV. Your phone. But at least you see it in London. I don't know. Like the coverage in London was something from 2001.
Yeah, the commentators weren't great either, were they? They weren't really giving much insight. I know there was one point he said about, I think it was the British runner, he said, he's still holding his bottle. That's fantastic. And I'm thinking, what, he's holding a bottle? It's nothing exciting really about it. There were a few things that they said. I know it's that the two male leaders passed a female runner who obviously was pretty well accomplished to be at that stage in the race. And as they passed her, they said, she'll have been glad to see Bekele in real life. I thought, well, how kind of patronizing is that? You know, it's like that's really made her day. She's probably on for like a 2:30 finish or something. And that's made her day. There were things like that. It was like they had the work experience kids in almost. So, yeah, that sort of
sounds like I was glad to miss it.
No, you if you'd watched it, you still would have missed it.
Yeah.
The thing about London that they do, and it gets them the world record for women, right, in a women's only race, is they start the women's race 20 to 25 minutes in front of the men's race, which is cool and all, but then it means that the third, fourth, fifth, and particularly the first and second British runners are finishing when the men are between 30 and 35. And you know that's when a men's race is breaking up because they put the pace setters out to go to 25. And then the pace setters go, and either the action kicks off right away or they play tactical caginess for 5K, and then it happens. So London always, every single year without fail, gets themselves into this mess where they end up showing us, and like, well done, you've qualified for the Olympics with a 2:27 or 2:28, I remember in the past, but you finished sixth or seventh, and meanwhile there's a 2:03, 2:02 happening behind you. And the frustrating thing is you can do both because they've got two streams in England. They can show the mass race and they can use that to cover the local athletes. And then the elite feed, which you know is going globally, can be the one that's dedicated to the front of the race, or you just split the screen. So none of these problems are insurmountable, and they haven't been insurmountable for 20 years, yet they've never done anything about it. And it makes me think that they sit in their meeting planning the coverage and they don't understand who they're actually speaking to. Because if they're catering to marathon watchers, they wouldn't deliver a product like that. But ostensibly it is to marathon watchers. So there's, I don't know, they just missed the audience in my opinion.
I don't know. I think perhaps the BBC have lost so many sports, so much of their coverage to other broadcasters that they don't really even know how to put on that really good show anymore. They've lost the experience perhaps in the back room and everything, and they just sort of floundering a bit when it comes to these big events. They just don't have the experience there anymore perhaps, because I noticed, did you see that message I sent you about the T100, the triathlon, the new triathlon?
They're
showing
the
heart rates of the athletes. I thought that was really interesting. At least they're trying to make endurance sport interesting, something to follow. And it gives the commentator something to talk about, which is, okay, it might be wildly inaccurate, the heart rate, but at least it's something that you can see that they've thought about the problem, whereas clearly the BBC probably haven't.
No, I agree.
Yeah, I mean, I think television commentary is a strange thing because sometimes you think, well, maybe I'm critical of whether it's television coverage of athletics or cycling or anything. You think, well, surely they can get commentators on this. And obviously there's a bigger picture, and there's a producer, and there's an organizer that's got a singular focus. But I'm always quite stunned by some of the commentators, you think this person shouldn't really be commentating an event. And I think there's a particular person in cycling, which I find absolutely annoying within, and I'm not even going to say the name, but that person still is often on television as a TV commentator. And I never understand how.
when I had my very brief stint, which ended in flames,
we used to work together a bit, I think.
We did. We commentated one year. We used to play games and give each other challenging words to try and insert into our commentary just to spice it up, because that was Two Oceans. I mean, that was a seven-hour broadcast. Imagine finding something to say in the fifth hour or the sixth hour when you're watching the back markers come through the halfway point, you know? But like the big thing that was glaringly lacking was feedback. No one was saying, and it was basic stuff, like did you modulate your voice and did you capture the emotion of the moment, or did you just drone on? And I actually ended up posting something on my website back at the time saying, please send me feedback, even if it's to insult me and criticize me. And one very kind reader actually sent me quite constructive feedback and said, you see, this is what you can do to improve. And I never got the chance, but I'm sure it would have made a difference. But like, if we're sitting as viewers saying, you know, that commentary isn't adding value, then surely someone else is going, we're spending seven figures on this. We've got the broadcast rights deal for this plus four other marathoners that we're going to use these people for. Let's at least think about trying to improve them. Now, you'd think it would be an obvious thing to try and figure out what the audience is thinking, but no one seems to care. That's weird.
Yeah. So just putting in perspective, when I was looking at the results of London, I just remembered to look up Calvin Kipton's performances over the last couple of years. I mean, he won the London Marathon in 2023 and he broke the course record by 16 seconds, 2:01:35. And of course, he went on to then do the 2:35 at Chicago in 2023. And obviously, for those of you following athletics, know that he died in a car crash early this year. But it shows you what a remarkable athlete he was. And you feel the sadness, really, to understand that if he was still alive, you know, how far could he have taken this? Could he have been that athlete that would have broken 2 hours? At the moment, it looks like there aren't many athletes. In fact, right now, I don't think there's anybody who's capable of getting below that 2 hour mark. Now, whereas he realistically thought like he could actually break 2 hours potentially at Chicago.
That's right. Yeah, I think part of my being underwhelmed with London was that. You know, the men's race went through halfway faster than Kipton did last year. And the winners ended up 2.5 minutes slower.
Yeah.
Because Kipton broke 60 minutes for that second half. It was unreal.
Unreal.
And then he did the same thing when he broke the world record. In London, only two guys got even within a minute of of the front group anyway, got within a minute of their halfway split. There was one athlete, I don't know why he finished, to be honest with you, but I'm actually going to look up his splits here because you've never seen such a preposterous race pattern. His name was Safer Tura from Ethiopia, 61:29 at halfway, and then 94:51 for the second half.
Right.
So he finished in 2:36. Presumably there was some contractual reason or a prize money reason for him to finish. Because why would you suffer for 1:34 too? Whereas even the winner ran 61:29 and 62:30. So that's a 1 minute positive split. Which is, for these guys, like, that's a failed race.
It's 1 minute negative split, isn't it?
No, negative if the second half's faster.
Right, okay.
So that's almost like a failed race. But him and Bekele are the only people who finished anything like remotely in the top five from that front group. Tola, Atanawu, Mengesha, Maiteko, Gebrselassie, Walder, all did not finish off that pace. And Kipton broke 60 off that pace. So it shows you the difference between Kipton and the rest.
Yeah, it does, though. It makes you realize that we potentially were robbed of a chance to see a legitimate sub-2 hour marathon in a big race with Kipton's passing away earlier this year. So yeah, very sad that.
One other thing. The men's coverage then, okay, now the race is done, so you can do what you want, I suppose. But Emil Kerris, who was the first Brit to finish and qualify for the Olympics, ran a very measured race. Like, I would think he might have even done a negative split. I haven't seen his first and second half. But his coach subsequently posted his training on Let's Run. It's an Italian coach called Renato Canova. And one of our discourse members has very productively and helpfully turned it into a spreadsheet and a track of exactly how many miles at what pace he did in the months leading up to London. So if you want insights into how an elite athlete is training, go on to Discourse and have a look for the topic that covers Emil Kerris, and you'll see people interpreting and discussing. It's really interesting.
Sure. That's very interesting. I want to have a look at that.
Yeah.
Interesting. One of the subjects that's come out of that, of course, is with the Paris Olympics now looming just 4 months away, what the Kenyans are going to do in terms of choosing their Olympic team. Now, as you can imagine, when you have a absolute dearth of talent in the Kenyan athletics, then you are struggling to now pick a top three. So they've announced that they're going to have they've got a shortlist of team members so far at the time of us doing this podcast. They've got to now reduce this down to 3 members for the women and 3 members for the men. But Kipchoge is on that shortlist, and there was some discussion on discourse as to whether he should be allowed to automatically take his place. He's obviously going for, you know, what's it, 3 Olympic golds now? So going for his 3rd one, and, you know, he's not as good as he used to be, but you can never count him out. So there was some discussion. And Gareth, I mean, your thoughts on Kipchoge? I mean, it's difficult to pick a Kenyan team where you don't pick Kipchoge.
Yeah, Kevin McQuaid brought this up on Discourse. I give him credit for that one because it's a really interesting thought. Is do we take somebody, or do the Kenyans take somebody with experience and knowledge of what it takes, or do they take somebody with that better form and perhaps more hunger for success? So has he earned that right to do it? Because they've got 5 preliminary runners they've chosen. They've got to cut it down to 3. And that doesn't even include Chebet, who came 3rd in Boston, though he did look a little bit out of form in Boston. I think he's coming back from an Achilles injury. So it's almost like it's a sentimental choice with Kipchoge against perhaps better runners. So the thing is that I think it's Kipchoge's coach is actually on the selection team, or I think he's one of the coaches for the Kenyan team. Which means that he's probably quite likely to go. I think they'll take him anyway, just for the name. It's such a it's going to be such a big occasion for him. Will he be overwhelmed on the day is another thing. I don't think so. I think he's got so much experience of running the breaking 2 when all the focus is on him anyway. But I'll be honest, I don't think he's probably winning Paris, even if they do take him. But what it got me thinking about was, these countries can only take 3 athletes. It almost feels like the Olympics is not taking all the best athletes or having all the best athletes in the world because of that limit, because the Kenyans have so many runners that could be involved. And then you've got, I'm not going to say lesser countries, that sounds wrong, but there are countries who will be sending people who might not, I think they've got, have they got to hit the qualifying time to be represented there, or because do they start looking further down if they can't fill their quota? Because you're going to get a lot of I don't want to use the word lesser. What's the word? Not quite as accomplished runners.
Not as accomplished. Yes.
Yeah, not as accomplished runners at the Olympics, which is great. That's their moment too. But it's not actually the cream of the crop, is it? Because you're not taking. You could have. Okay, admittedly, it would be full of Kenyans. But I was wondering if you could have a wildcard system where if a country can't get qualifiers in, then their spots would be given up to faster athletes, perhaps, if they've hit something even better than the Olympic qualifying. So if the Olympic qualifying is, say, 208.11, I think it is, if you can run under 205, then you get an automatic slot if there are slots available because there are only slower runners. But that's my thought. It just seems a little bit, since I looked into it a little bit, that we're not getting the cream of the crop in the Olympics. And that's what the Olympics is meant to be, isn't it?
I'll tell you why they'll never do that. Because part of the reason for capping it is to make it relevant and engaging and interesting to other countries.
Yeah.
Because otherwise it would look like the World Cross Country Championship. So I don't know if you saw that. The women's race, Kenya were in the front 6 of the race. I think they let it all sort itself out for the first lap, 2K. And then the 6 Kenyan women just go to the front of the race and it's done, over. And then you start saying, well, where's the first European going to come? And that's 23rd or whatever the case is. And the thing with 3 Kenyans and 3 Ethiopians is you then go into it as a South African, for instance, and you say, I got a chance here. If there's 8 Kenyans and 9 Ethiopians, you don't even go. That's the problem, right?
Mm. Yeah. I see what you're saying. But if you're that South African runner, you don't stand a chance anyway, really, do you? Unless you can run.
No, because 2 or 3 people can have a bad day. Mm. So Baldini could win the marathon in Athens. Remember the Italian that won it there? Because, yeah. And he wasn't, if they'd let 8 Kenyans and 8 Ethiopians in, he's not winning that marathon. I'll put my flag in the ground to say that. Similarly, we've seen American medal winners at the Olympic marathon, not Rupp, because I think Rupp was probably in that conversation against all the Kenyans. But I think you go in and you say, there are 8 athletes who can run 2:06, okay, these days in women's marathon, there are 8 athletes who can run 2:18 or faster. I'm at 2:24, I'm no chance.
Yeah.
But if there's only a few, you say, one injured, one goes out too fast, I'm in the chance now, I'm in the conversation. So they keep it down in order to make it flatter.
Mm. Also, the Olympics is about participation and representation rather than always performance. They do celebrate everybody in the field, whether they are going to be the medalists or not.
Yeah, but it's funny. Like we've got our athletes, Kat Estain, right? What was their SA record? 2:24.
Mm.
Imagine looking at that and saying, I'm 8 minutes behind.
Yeah, she's not going to feature.
It's just...
But yet she's a brilliant runner.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's amazing to think. And if you stack that race with Valencia, or New York, when she ran, it wouldn't have been the SA record. That was in Valencia. She didn't even make the top 10.
Mm.
So
maybe she'll have a better chance than Paris because it is a slightly different course to the normal flat routes we see from the top runners. So maybe, the stronger runners might do better.
Maybe. But again, if you had 20 East Africans, then you'd need 17 of them to have a bad day.
Yeah.
Or to fail to get them out of 6 makes it viable.
Mm.
Yeah. Mm. But anyway, Kipchoge will go. They'll pick him for sure. They'll never leave him out.
Mm.
But once I think, and I say this now, having just seen Bekele prove me wrong, once the trajectory in a marathon starts to trend down, it's very difficult to turn it around again. And when you look at Kipchoge, even in COVID, remember he lost that special COVID London marathon, but that was exceptional circumstance. So you can, okay, cool. Boston last year, 6th. Tokyo this year, 10th. To me, that's going the wrong way. And to turn that around enough to win a medal in the Olympics is very difficult. And so I agree with Gareth and many of you on Discourse. I cannot see him winning a medal. I think he'll be there with 32K gone. But when that race starts to get shaken up, then the guys who can run 2:03 now will be, it's not going to be.
But they won't, as you said, they won't be necessarily that depth. And Kipchoge's only 39. So he's 2 years younger than Bekele.
Officially.
Yeah. Yes. Well, depends what you see there. But I mean,
Kipchoge was in the Olympics in 2004. So he's 20 years of Olympics, eh?
Yeah. It's incredible.
It's unreal.
Yeah. Now, I wouldn't count him out, to be honest with you. I think he's got the experience and I think he's got the sort of aura around
him. It does speak to earlier points, incidentally. If there were 20 other East Africans, then he's not winning a medal. In my
opinion. Yes, but he's got a chance.
Yeah, exactly. So actually he's the beneficiary of the capping himself now.
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
So let's see what happens there. It's going to be an interesting one to focus on. So
there's other sports, incidentally, just out of interest, where the same situation happens, right? Like swimming, Australia and the USA could probably send twice as many swimmers who'd make finals, but then you wouldn't see as many from the other countries. Cycling, Switzerland has this problem in mountain biking. They could win 2 podiums worth of medals.
Yeah.
Men and women. In fact, they did win the last podium worth of medals for the women. So it's a tough gig if you're the fourth or fifth best mountain biker in Switzerland or the fourth best freestyler in Australia or the US.
But then some of the Olympic stories that we always remember is people like Eric the Eel. Was he from Ghana?
Equatorial Guinea.
Equatorial Guinea, there we go. And he was the skier. It was the skier.
Eddie the Eagle.
Eddie the Eagle, there we go. So
the movie about him, I think it was called, was it called The Eagle, Gareth, that movie?
I can't remember, but I remember him. He was great.
Yeah.
And let's not forget.
So, I take it back that was a terrible suggestion. That's why I'm not on the Olympic committee.
And then, of course, the Jamaican bobsled team, I mean, they made a movie out of that. So,
do you remember that?
There is a space for this.
The best one of all, and I can't remember his name. Maybe Gareth will find it now. Was an Australian short track speed skater. Right? Was it Bradbury? Someone like that. Who won gold. Because everyone in front of him fell over in the last corner. And so he was the only guy who made the finish line.
And he wasn't likely to...
No, he was a complete outsider. He wasn't Eddie the Eagle and Eric the Eel levels of outsiderness. But it was like an unbelievable moment where the two people in front in racing for the win took one another out and everyone behind him. And he was so far behind. Okay, he'd made the final, so he was good. But he was so far behind that he came through and won gold in that particular race. That was in... 2006 or something.
Did you just say his name?
I thought it was Bradbury or something.
Oh, Stephen Bradbury. How do you,
there you go.
You got to get out more. It was 2002. It was 2002 though in Salt Lake City. So
okay,
there you go. Yeah.
I'll let you off.
So we'll put a video in the show notes of those stories.
Those stories are stuff that kind of sticks in our mind. As much as we celebrate the achievements of all the best athletes, those are the legendary stories that keep the Olympics alive, and they show the spirit of the events, which I kind of agree with to some extent. And it's country against country as opposed to athlete against athlete. So you have the chance of an outsider winning. You have the chance of a country that might not normally have a shoe-in to be in the top level having a chance. You know, so I think it's always a good thing. I mean, I'm trying to remember when Emma Coburn won the steeplechase. Was that an Olympic Games? I'm just trying to remember now. But I think that was another where she was a relative outsider, won one of the major events. And I don't know if it's Olympics or World Championships, but I don't think she would have stood the same chance if there'd been, you know, 15 East Africans there. But anyway,
in fairness to her, she was at her peak. She was very good.
She was good, absolutely. Anyway,
that was a World Championship, by the way.
Was the World Championships. Okay, so maybe not qualifying as much.
Stay tuned for more.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Talking about track and field and athletics, we've had a few discussions about this in the past, about where the sport of track and field in particular is around the world. And I think we all have our own views on it. And certainly for me, as somebody who used to absolutely love track and field, I don't get as excited about it as I did do maybe 10, 15 years ago. And I think to some extent, there is a lot of pressure, and that's not pressure that we're just saying based on our opinions here. That's quite obvious that track and field as a global sport is struggling to compete for eyeballs, not only in terms of television coverage, but in terms of sponsorship deals, in terms of attracting new talent into the sport. You know, you look at sports like basketball and American football that are attracting really top athletes, and those athletes aren't going to track and field because it's not as cool as it used to be. And I had the opportunity last year to go to the World Championships in Budapest and see the kind of athletes that are coming through into the track and field space that are certainly right up in terms of their performances, but you feel like there's this pressure for them to create hype. And the reason why I'm giving you this background is that there's been a couple of two announcements recently. Michael Johnson, who was the multiple Olympic medalist and 400-meter world record holder for a while, and Barry Kahn, who is a sort of event organizer, have come up with two new events. Barry Kahn's event is what they call a duel. So in other words, they're proposing that it's one athlete versus another athlete over various distances, and then they have it over a couple of days. And then Michael Johnson hasn't given specifics about his event, but he's suggesting that there's going to be an events in 2025 which will be hyped up. There'll be limited events. There'll be a chance for the sport to really get some recognition. So, I mean, Gareth, I'm going to kick off with you. What is your perception of track and field? If you're looking at it from a sports lover's perspective, do you think it's struggling realistically?
Well, it was a world record last weekend, wasn't it? Did you see it about it? It was... No, you're shaking your head because I think Duplantis broke the pole vault world record.
Oh,
last
did he
weekend.
Break it again? Goodness me.
And Xiamen in the first Diamond League. Yeah,
but sure. your reaction says it all, that you haven't heard about it.
I should know that.
And I think the discus went the week before. And it was actually a post I put on Discourse and say, did anybody actually notice this? Because I didn't notice for a few days that world records were being broken and nobody seemed to know. And that pretty much sums up the athletics at the moment, doesn't it? Or at least the field part of it, because there's just no eyes on it.
Well, that was the oldest world record in men's athletics, I think. Is that right, Gareth? No, the discus.
Oh, discus, okay.
I think his father held it before as well.
I don't think he was the world record holder, but he was definitely the Olympic champion.
Yeah.
He's a Lithuanian fella. And the video went around on social media a few days before that. And I saw it and I thought it was a practice session.
Yeah, it was in a field, saying, wasn't it? It was just like in a field.
There was no. I almost replied and said that that's not a legit world record because you can't break the world record in training. It looked like a training session.
Really?
It was unreal. I couldn't believe that it was verified, but I suppose.
And then, why did you think it was a training session? Just because
it's a
it didn't look like there was people there?
Yeah, it looked like it was a discus cage with a net, and a guy walks in, and it's like a static camera. It's not like you see a polished coverage on Diamond League. He throws it. You can't even see the discus land. Mm. So someone's obviously been on the other end over the horizon, 74 meters and something centimeters later, measured it, world record, done, okay, in a sanctioned event. But there was nobody watching it. It was a staged discus throw.
Right. Okay.
So, cool.
And so and you're talking about Duplantis. That was at a Diamond
League event. That was a proper one, yeah.
Okay.
Well, they're both proper, but that one looked like a proper one.
Yeah. Because Duplantis, obviously, he broke the very old record of Sergei Bubka a couple of years ago, and that he's kind of continued on since then. And, I mean, Sergei Bubka was, you know, people felt that his record, I think, was 6.12. That was that people thought nobody would ever break that, and now he's gone way beyond. So
Duplantis is doing the Bubka thing of breaking it by 1 centimeter every time. I reckon Duplantis is probably capable of 15 centimeters higher. Just keep breaking until 2038.
Yeah, get the bonuses.
So
he's spectacular to watch, though. My word, it really is quite amazing watching him in the pole vault. I mean, technically, I don't understand the pole vault like a pole vaulter does, but watching it live and seeing somebody like that doing it at the top level is extraordinary. I mean, they literally push up off the pole and over the top, and it's just the technique involved is just amazing to me. I mean, it really is flying through the air.
Mm.
So I find it extraordinary, you know. So yeah, it is. I mean, interesting, I was watching the very awkward Laureus Awards. I don't know whether you guys have watched the Laureus Awards live on television. I mean, they do a great job. It's supported by Johan Rupert, the South African gazillionaire, and it's held this year in Madrid. And they have all the top sportsmen from around the world. By the way, Novak Djokovic was Sportsman of the Year, and that was for the fifth time. And the awards themselves, I mean, in essence, the Laureus do a great job in terms of developing sports around the world, but the awards themselves are so cringy and so badly done that I almost want to, like, I can't watch it for very long. But it's he was one. Duplantis was up there as one of the nominees for Sportsman of the Year and didn't win it, but certainly shows you how his importance in the world of sport is on athletics.
Yeah, he's one of a handful of big names. And I was actually, Michael Johnson, who we'll get onto, has recently posted something on Twitter saying there's a perception among the media that track and field lacks personalities like Bolt, Carl Lewis, and him. And he says, my personality wasn't nearly as exciting as Noah Lyles, Shaqiri, Shelley Ann, Carsten, Jakob, Ingebrigtsen. I'd add Mondo Duplantis to that. And the problem in athletics isn't a lack of personalities. The problem is that the sport is no longer a platform for great personalities.
Mm.
So obviously at some point in the future, Johnson is going to try and change that platform, right? Because he's got this idea for a new way to deliver athletics to us that will make Mondo Duplantis more well-known than Novak Djokovic. So he wins that award next time he's nominated.
Yeah.
But I don't know what it is. Like when I watch athletics meetings in Europe, and Budapest was really well attended, no?
Yeah, 100% packed every day.
Now,
incredible.
For the next two Olympics, not Olympics, Worlds, they're going to go to, okay, maybe I'm doing Japan a disservice. But they take it to places where it's not going to be well attended. Mm-hmm. And then you have this perception that the sport is really struggling. Diamond League kicks off in Xiamen in a stadium that was 25% full. You think, what's wrong with athletics?
Mm-hmm.
When they go to Zurich and Brussels, okay, Brussels is not Diamond League anymore. No, it is. It's Berlin that's not. Paris, those places, they'll fill it. You say, this is a healthy sport. So what's the challenge for them, right? Is it new markets or is it losing its current markets?
Mm-hmm. And also whether Michael Johnson's comments are based on the fact that he wants to launch a new event. So is he being legitimately raising the concern around the future of the sport to further his endeavors in his new event? Or does he genuinely believe the sport has a marketing?
I'm sure he wants to do his event because he believes there's a problem. So he thinks he can deliver something a little bit better. What does that look like? I don't know. I mean, that's a very long conversation, but certainly, people who watch on television, I think, wouldn't appreciate how dynamic and athletic athletes are.
Yeah.
Because the coverage doesn't show you that. So, for instance, the cameras on athletes would make a big difference.
Mm.
No one wants to wear a GoPro on their head when they're running an 800, though.
No, exactly.
But it would be a cool way to add insight to the package, I think. drone footage, for instance, has added a little bit more to cycling. Well, yeah. Cycling's not struggling.
No.
And conceptually, it's quite similar to track and field.
Hmm. Could be boring perceptually, but actually coverage makes a big difference. And television coverage is everything. There's no doubt. I mean, if good television coverage can change the way the sport is perceived by the masses, you know, and I think, yeah. I mean, they have tried different things. They've had, you know, lit tracks, and they've got markers on the side of the track which show people where the world record markers and how far they are behind. Mm. Those sort of things are all interesting. But, you know, I always think the biggest problem is that there is always a focus around records and times as opposed to what Barry Kahn, this event organizer, is proposing. It should be around the jewels. So once you take out pace setters, for instance, at Diamond League events, you can then focus on the race and not necessarily the time. And I've always maintained focus on the race because that's what people want to watch. I don't know the difference between a 145 800 meters and a 143 visually, but I can appreciate a good race. Mm. And I think that's the key. And I think if there was a nice focus on there, but I think big events want to have, oh, we had a world record here. We had 5 world records there. I'm not sure that's good for TV. Gareth, what are your thoughts on that?
I think it's the coverage itself is not enough proper coverage on TV, perhaps on terrestrial TV in the UK. You've got to go and look for it. Like the Diamond League is on, but you've got to go and search for it somewhere. I did notice, I put it in the thread about the Michael Johnson, the Diamond League coverage in the US is moving to a very niche subscription service called Flow Track, because NBC, I think, used to own it. The coverage, and they've let that go, and they said that's a very telling thing that NBC have let it go because they simply don't value it anymore, and so people are going to have to pay to watch this small subscription service, which takes it out of the public eye. It's only going to be the enthusiasts that stay, and the general public just aren't going to see any Diamond League meetings in the US. Well, yeah. That's certainly not helping the sport in any way, and you're going to end up with just the Olympics and the World Championships being the only relevant competitions.
And to some extent the American market is critically important for a sport's global coverage, really, isn't it? I mean, it's probably the defining one.
I would say so too. I mean, it's a topic I think we're probably about to roll into next, and that's the prize money in the Olympics. Why that is being brought in, because if people haven't heard, there's likely to be prize money just from World Athletics brought in. Are they trying to keep people in the sport by doing that? Do they realize that there's a problem?
Yeah. Well, let's kick into that. I mean, that is a nice segue into this topic, and I mean, I've got some strong views on this, and I think we probably all do. So there is, they have announced that they're going to be giving prize money to the medalists at the Olympics, and what's it, $50,000, I think, for gold medals. But it's obviously raised. It's fairly polarizing because there's a lot of people, not only on our Discourse channel, but obviously on the Twitterverse and the zeitgeist of our internet, who say that this is moving away from the spirit of the Olympic Games. There are those that say, why not pay the top athletes? Because the Olympic Games is making a lot of money out of television coverage, and where does that money go, et cetera, et cetera. So it's quite wrapped up in a lot of different conversations. I mean, Ross, what are your thoughts on whether Olympic medalists should get prize money?
Yeah, of course they should. They're professionals. So it's weird to me that they hadn't already. When I saw it, I thought, well, is there no prize at all? I mean, World Athletics will give them their own championships.
Mm.
So is it because of the Olympics? And is there some aura around the Olympics that means that we don't need to pay them because the prestige of winning an Olympic medal is that high? I don't think that's the case anymore. Maybe it was once upon a time, but the world has changed. So if everything else is paid for like you're a professional, then treat people like professionals. And the reality is it's not going to, you know, they're going to pay them. It's not Super Bowl, NFL player, baseball player levels of prize money and earnings, but it's something. And it's a symbolic thing that I think shows that it's a professional sport.
Yeah.
The problem, I think, and the reason that when World Athletics announced that they would pay, then there was blowback, is because if you're a modern pentathlon or weightlifting or archery or whatever other sport in the Olympic Games, you can't match that payment. Because for all the talk we've had in the last 10 minutes about how small World Athletics is, and it's a niche sport, they can at least afford to pay mid 5 figures, right? They were talking 50,000.
50,000, yeah.
There's no way weightlifting's paying 50,000 for every gold medalist in the Olympic Games. So now they're going to be shown up by it. And that's why there's blowback. But there's no doubt that it's in principle, it's the way you've got to go.
Yeah, so I mean, just to clarify, so it's World Athletics that are paying these this bonus, and Sebastian Coe has defended this against this idea of that it's against the spirit of the Olympic Games, whereas the IOC, which runs the Olympic Games, has been a bit blindsided by this and saying that they, you know, they've always believed that just competing in the Games is reward enough. So that's why it's become an interesting one, and I agree with you 100%. I mean, why not? If you're a good indication of this is we were talking about the marathons. If you're a very good marathon runner, surely you're going to go where the money is. And the big money is at the big major events around the world. It's not necessarily the Olympic Games. So I'm always surprised. Obviously, there are benefits in terms of sponsorship and all sorts of bonuses from sponsors for a guy like Kipchoge when he wins the Olympic marathon. But in effect, the money that they get is small compared to what they would get at a major marathon. And so I think it's a great move that athletics is doing this because they really are raising the importance of the Olympic Games in the world of athletics. And I guess there's going to be pressure now on all the other sports to do the same. Now, Gareth, what are your thoughts? I mean, it is a controversial one. Where do you stand on this?
Well, I'm not even going to argue with you because I agree with you both, and so does Discourse. I think that everybody deserves to get paid for what they're doing. The Olympics hasn't been amateur since, 1992 was the dream team? And as a few of the athletes have brought up, there are plenty of professionals in the Olympics now. There are the golfers and the baseball players. I think soccer players are probably... Are they amateur? I'm not sure. But there are plenty of... pro athletes who are now competing in the Olympics. So why shouldn't the amateurs get their cut too? It's probably the IOC don't want to end up shelling out, do they? Because they like their money. I know that they hand out a certain percentage of their revenue, which is in the billions, to each of the federations of all the sports that make up the Olympics. So in effect, they're paying World Athletics to pay their athletes in contrary to what they want to happen, which is kind of weird. But I was reading that the commitment of the Olympic movement is to maintain no more than 10% of all revenue to go into administration. And so if it is only 10%, then they've still got, I don't know, $6.5 billion or so to, so I'm sure they could afford to pay the athletes. But if it comes down to individual federations, like Ross said, that they won't have the money to do it because they're going to, it's only gold medals getting 50,000 this time, and then they're going to branch out and all medal winners in athletics will get it in the next Olympics, although I've also heard that it's going to be everybody who participates in athletics at the next one. So in Discourse, it actually turned into how the IOC is funded. There's a long thread from Run Hike Bird, Kevin again, looking at how the IOC distributes its money. So I think the Olympic values are really important. As we went back to earlier on, it's about the athletes really want to compete, and that's why they keep it's country versus country. But at the same time, you've got sports like swimming, cycling, the athletes, this is the interesting part. The athletes are saying, yes, we want to be paid. Why should we be treated any different to athletics? Mm. And then you'd speak to the federations, or the federations have spoken, such as the British Olympic Association, Andy Anson, who's questioning ending the 128-year tradition, it says. So BOA don't want to be spending out of their pocket. The same with cycling. I think the head of the UCI, whose name escapes me now, that's right, he's come out against it. No, I would have thought the UCI probably has the money to pay its cyclists. I don't know, so why he's come against it, I don't know. But yeah, the opinion on Discourse is definitely pay the athletes what they deserve.
Yeah, there's a good quote in the story on The Guardian, which we'll put in the show notes, from Coe, where he says, "I came from an era where to compete for the UK it was a second class rail ticket or a 5p per mile allowance. And you went from that one that was the best margin and a 75p meal voucher," he said. "My view is that the world has really changed. It's really important that where possible, we create a sport that is financially viable for our competitors." And I think we all agree on that. But to let us know if you don't agree with that, because it is an interesting debate.
One interesting thing you brought up, like with the best, why did the best marathoners go even to the Olympic Games?
Yeah.
Remember, they didn't used to do that to the World Championships. I was just looking now. between 1991, remember it's every 2 years, so 1, 3, 95, 97, 99. So that's five world championships. How many East Africans were in the top 10 across five world championships? So that's 50 top 10 places, guess.
How many East Africans?
Yeah.
Across all those five events?
Yeah. No, I lost five world championships. So 50 places in the top 10 across five world championships.
So I would say they've got 10 of them.
Three.
Okay.
East Africans, the Kenyans and Ethiopians didn't used to go to world champs.
Right. Okay. So they didn't.
Whereas when you look from 2007, 9, 11, they win it all. They're winning them all. They occupy 80% of the podiums. And so something changed. And I remember that actually. I used to watch the World Champ Marathon and used to see Spanish, Japanese, Italian, South African running for the US. Mark Plaikis in 1993 won that world title. Exactly. And that was financial incentives to get those athletes to those marathons.
Mm.
So they did used to choose. And the Olympics, you see, is always traded on its prestige. You can be an Olympic champion, therefore no prize money. But that's not, it's just so quaint.
Mm.
Mm. I've heard rumors that Asifa won't be going to the Paris Olympics, would rather focus on Berlin, possibly because the course doesn't suit her, but it's the same sort of thing.
Mm.
Yeah,
because the appearance fee and the world record fee that you get, it's enormous, right? So there is a premium attached to winning, and you'd have to value the Olympic title by a factor of 10 more than you value money.
Yes, you can monetize it, obviously. But
the direct, it's 200, let's say it's 250, like 100 appearance fee, 250 for the world record, and your sponsor matches it. So you made 600 in one marathon.
Yeah.
So 50 at the Olympics. And then you say, but hang on, as the Olympic champion, think about the next five marathons. The guy says, I'm not thinking about five marathons from now. I'm thinking about one.
Mm.
So I'll go to Berlin. So the fact that they even send the top athletes to the Olympics is actually indicative of how valuable the Olympic Games is, but it still needs to be prize moneyed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So that's certainly going to be something that to watch out for, and whether other sports follow. I think, as Gareth has said, maybe the UCI and the richer sports and the Olympic program might well do a lot to get making sure that the best athlete. I guess at the end of the day, you want the best athletes that you can possibly get at Olympic Games to make sure that they are credible. Whereas in the smaller sports, I'm thinking things like rowing and sailing and those sort of events, there's not the same money, but the prestige of winning an Olympic medal for those sportsmen who are supposedly more amateur, although a lot of them are professional, just the prestige of winning that gets them funding from federations and et cetera, et cetera. So that's an interesting one. Just moving on to the sport of cycling. For those of you who have been following some of the discussions, and this has happened a while ago, but there has been some discussion around cycling safety. And the big story a couple of weeks ago was the crash at the Basque Country race, where it took out Jonas Vingegaard, Remco Evenepoel, and Primoz Roglic, the big four out of the Tour de France, all crashing. I mean, Roglic was the best off of all of them. Vingegaard looks like he might not even make the Tour de France at this rate. Evenepoel, collarbone. I mean, it was a big crash, but it's generated the discussion around safety, and I'm not really sure why, because it was an accident, but I don't think it was necessarily anybody's fault, other than the fact that the riders were just going around a corner too fast.
It happens. It generates the discussion because it's not in isolation. Remember, 2 weeks before that, or 1 week before that, we lost Van Aert and Stuyven in that crash in, which one was it? It would have been Dwars de Vlaanderen.
Mm-hmm.
So that, like, its face, it ruined the classics a little bit, right? Monument season, especially the cobbles.
Mm-hmm.
This crash, in my opinion, compromises the Tour de France this year. Pogacar could win the Tour de France on a unicycle now.
Let's hope not.
No, but if you ride the race with one leg, and he'll win it.
I know.
Like the Giro. Like, is the Giro valuable to watch? Yeah, maybe I'm going to watch the Giro to see who wins some stages. But so crashes are very, the impact of a crash is significant. Now, we know they happen a lot, but when they happen and take out three of the big race favorites, and previously to that, Wout van Aert, who's like the big monument favorite, then they get disproportionate coverage. So that's why it's a conversation. I don't know whether the rate of crashing and the injuries from crashing are higher or not, because no one's got any historical data that can inform this conversation. So every time it comes up, like it has on discourse, my point is the same, is that until cycling gets systematic about understanding how often crashes happen, why they happen, and how they happened, they can't have informed discussions about this. It's like what's happening now with cycling is like when there's a shark attack here in Fishhook and they say, close the beaches.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay, but the one shark attack, cool. There's two. Oh, it's an epidemic of shark attacks. Sharks are changing. Sharks are evolving to hunt humans. You know what I mean? Like there's a disproportionate spotlight effect.
100%, yeah.
It's an availability bias that's in play here, I think. But the conversation about the accidents probably needs to be had, but it can't be had because of these. It needs to be had over 10 years.
You see, I don't understand it because one of the stories that's come out of this is the UCI's new Safe Pro Cycling Initiative, which is called Safer. They basically got rid of their CEO, Jop van Hulsen, basically because they said that there was more accidents. 38 apparently riders were now injured in 2023, and that wasn't acceptable. But accidents in cycling are like part of the sport. It seems impossible that you can put measures in place to reduce the number of accidents unless there is something critically wrong with either the fact that spectators are too close to the course or there is a cobble in the wrong place. I mean, it seems impossible that somebody could be responsible for making professional cycling safe.
The thing is, now you're listing specific questions about what caused the accident. So you're in fact asking for a systematic process in order to answer those questions.
Yes, I suppose.
And that doesn't exist.
So what you're saying is Jop, before he was let go, should have done research into what the cause of accidents
is. As I understand it. And again, I'm biased a little bit by my own knowledge, but in rugby, for instance, and in football, the same things exist. These fairly comprehensive injury surveillance systems that identify exactly how many injuries happen, how severe. You know, like in football and in rugby, if you get a hamstring strain this weekend, someone is documenting it within your team that it took you 31 days to return to normal training. And then that goes into a database and we track hamstring injuries sustained while sprinting and exactly what time of the match it is. And then over time, you gain this knowledge about what the risk factors are. We're doing that all the time for concussions. Feels to me that cycling might have some information on this because I read that stat, like you said, 38 athletes injured so far.
What was it in
1995?
Well, here's an interesting set. This is a story on Cycling Weekly. We do a great job. And they said, in fact, pro cycling, this is for 2024, according to pro cycling stats, reported a total of 135 injuries so far this year. In 2023, saw the most injuries since 2014 at 296. So there's a perception, well, not a perception, there's a reality that there are more accidents.
Mm.
So what you're saying is...
Why?
Why?
Because now you've got to get those teams to say, what were the circumstances around that accident? Has the proportion of accidents in the last 3 kilometers of a race, especially on a flat stage, stayed the same, but in the first 50 has gone up? Because, okay, then it's aggressive racing in the first 50 Ks. Are there accidents happening on descents? In which case I'd be thinking the speeds are too high. And then you'd say, well, why might that be? Well, could it be the disc brakes are allowing athletes to brake later and more forcefully in corners and therefore carry 6 kilometers an hour faster than they would with rim brakes? If I were to discover that, then I would suggest one thing that they need to discuss is whether they should ban disc brakes. You know, like, so that's the kind of thing. Are the accidents because of road furniture? Saw a couple in the monuments where cyclists hit signs in the middle of islands. Okay, well, why might that be? Do we need to tie balloons to them and make them more prominent so that the cyclists can see them from further away? Is it an education thing? I listened to some people talking about, in fact, Mathieu van der Poel said this. He says the biggest problem is rider behavior, which is true, but you can modify rider behavior. Just because it's rider behavior doesn't mean we have to throw our hands up and say we can't do anything about this. Is it the spectators causing more accidents? In which case, there's a new solution for that. So you understand that you can ask and you can start by saying, okay, we've seen an increase in accidents. Then we have to start understanding why. And only then can you start thinking about solutions. The moment it feels to me people are chucking ideas around without necessarily knowing that there's a basis for them.
Yeah. I mean, there was some study that came out of the Ghent University where they suggested that looking at some of the results of these crashes, 50% of crashes were due to rider behavior, with 50% due to other factors such as obstacles that are not signaled or the speed of the peloton.
If you're going along at 65 k an hour and then you hit something in the road, is that rider behavior or was it the thing in the road? Because if you've been going 55, you wouldn't have hit it. So and maybe they've got all this, but they certainly don't communicate and publish it, you know. And whereas in football and certainly in rugby, the stuff gets published, so it's available. And maybe I'm doing a disservice to them. I want to put that out there that maybe they have all this, but I don't think they have it in anything like the detail they need to have informed conversations about exactly how to do it. And instead, it seems that they're relying on acquired wisdom, which is so vulnerable to bias.
Yeah. And as you say, maybe looking at the data suggests a solution rather than just saying, well, that's racing. I mean, I'm sure we all have our own theories about why cycling potentially has high injury rates. I mean, I think it's much more aggressive now than it ever has been. But anyway, I mean, that's
something. It definitely
throwing,
is. Yeah. I mean, the speeds on that corner where they all went off in the Basque Country were insanely high.
Yeah.
But it didn't look like a dangerous corner unless the surface was really uneven. You know, sometimes you get tar that melts and then it makes those little ripples. Maybe that's the problem. And in that case, there needs to be some principle that, like, guided areas like that need to be more clearly signposted and painted over the day before the race comes through so that they're clear to the riders. In that specific instance, if some of those riders hadn't gone into that concrete ditch, they wouldn't have been nearly as badly injured, thinking they're Jay Vine. So then you say, okay, accidents may happen. Can we protect the rider from the consequence of the accident? That's also a safer way to run cycling. And so maybe the mistake that was made there was to not pad that ditch up.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, it just feels, what caused Gino Maeder's death? Still don't know. High speed. Yeah. Okay, cool. But you can't ask him to slow down. You have to make them slow down.
Yeah.
Or you have to deal with the consequences of high speed.
It's a bit like the hairpin before the Forest of Orenburg.
That was a good example. That was a good example. So everyone said, well,
that's away from the spectacle.
All that's going to do is move the point of the accident somewhere else was the biggest criticism. Now it's a race to get into that chicane. And say, okay, but that's probably, they were happy with that outcome because it's far better to crash on the tarmac than to crash on those cobbles. I can guarantee you that.
Yes, and the riders asked for that.
So that was actually an example of, like, I can see the logic behind it. They could have maybe done it a little bit better, but maybe not with the time available to them. So I don't know. The whole conversation feels a little bit knee-jerkerish and guesswork-like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whereas I think there's, as you say, what your work on World Rugby, for instance, gives an indication of the kind of data that you need to get before you start making decisions.
Yeah, and Gareth can comment because he's seen it in the discourse. But the guy that they fired, like, I assume – or that was let go from that role with Safer Cycling. I assume he was put there to try and address some of these issues. But then I gathered that he was actually an employee of Visma.
Used to be, yeah. From what I gather, yeah.
I thought Sol's chief operations officer, Gareth. Do I have that wrong?
I think he was ex, wasn't he? Off the top of my head. I think he, Van Houten was sharing, his time between Safer and his former role as chief operating officer at Visma Leasebike, who was ousted. Because it sounds like he wasn't doing his job in a way. He wasn't getting the data that they need, because that was the whole point of Safer, was to gather this data. And somebody said on Discourse, why hasn't the data been published? And it's probably because they weren't correcting it properly, and that's why he's not in his job anymore.
But the reason they weren't collecting it properly is because he's with a team.
Yeah, probably.
That's the equivalent of World Rugby letting Harlequins be responsible for English injury club data and Leinster collect all the data from the URC. Like, nobody in there... No, look, the politics of the situation mean that nobody would give data on injuries, which have implications for performance, to someone who's linked to someone you think is a rival. It's mad that you don't set it up independently. So it seems really silly to me.
The UCI said... about it, it said it became clear that the work carried out to date has not lived up to the objective set, particularly in a context in which too many accidents have occurred. So, yeah, it basically wasn't collecting the data as it should have been. By the you were absolutely right about that corner in the Basque Country, but apparently it was well known by the local riders who ride it that it's a dangerous corner. I saw a podcast with Remco Evenepoel describing the crash, and there were bumps in the road. I think you texted that at the time, that you thought there were bumps in the road, and he lost contact, one of his wheels lost contact while he was braking, doing I think 87 kilometers an hour.
His Strava file showed him leaving the road at 78 or something.
78 to 87 or 78, yeah. When his wheel made contact again, it just threw him off to the left and off he went into the woods. So, but if they knew about the corner, or the riders knew about the corner, then surely somebody, the race director, should have known about the corner and it being a notorious, dangerous corner, because it's completely changed the face of cycling for this year now, hasn't it?
Yep.
But how do you do that over 280 kilometre race is another question entirely.
Well, because someone's job.
Somebody's job, I guess, is to know the route that intimately. So. Mm.
It's true. I mean, they have race officials out on the course with flags when there's road furniture in the way. So why not have one on a descent which shows a dangerous descent?
I tuned into that broadcast just before it happened, like literally 3 minutes before. And there was a group of four up the road, and they were literally showing a replay of one of those four coming back onto the road, having gone off at exactly that same corner into the grass, like Evenepoel did.
Mm.
And so group of four in front, under no particular pressure of being in a peloton, overshot the same corner.
Mm.
So now, even you think, okay, maybe there's a problem with this corner.
Yeah, if we hadn't have lost four favourites for the Ford Tour de France, would we be having this conversation now? Is the other question.
Yes, that's, would it be? Yeah.
No, we wouldn't.
No, we wouldn't, unfortunately.
No doubt.
That's the sad thing about it. Yeah. Just on another topic, I mean, it's a little bit off the topic around safe cycling, but there was some dramatic footage of the weather at La Flèche Blonde where 44 riders, including all the favourites, pulled out of the race. And I watched some of the highlights on the Lenten Rouge YouTube, where they showed the race early on in the stage looking pretty decent weather, and they were wearing short sleeve, and then suddenly the rain came down, the hail eventually came down. You could see the hail off the back of the riders. And I mean, Ross, you'll understand some of the science behind this, because those riders going into now 1-2 degrees Celsius with wind chill factor, it was dramatic, because we saw people like Matthias Schillmuser actually carried to a car like a child, because he was so cold, and lots of riders pulled out of the race just because of the cold, which is quite rare, surprisingly so.
Yeah, so remember, there's that saying, no such thing as bad weather, only bad clothing.
Yeah,
but in cycling, it's really difficult. I've not found a solution for cold, wet days that allows me to be warm enough descending and not overheating up. So when you have a route that requires both those things, a bit of climbing and a bit of descending, and you then have cold, wet days, I think it is really difficult. And if those teams can't get it right, then it shows you that actually you're pretty close to the limits of trying to balance those two imperatives.
Yeah.
And the other thing I think that's happening there is you would have to change clothing a lot. You know, you could get the jacket off once it's wet and then put something dry on so that you don't then, because this is that convective cooling effect in that heat removal, as it were. Mm. But the pressure on the racer doesn't allow that to happen. And maybe there's also concerns around aerodynamic losses and disadvantages that they're trying to juggle. So in the end, they put their chips down that we're going to stay warm with the barest minimum of compromised performance. And they all lost that bet on that particular day.
Yeah.
The thing with Schillmuser, though, is I couldn't understand why it took him. I mean, by the time he was carried off the road, he must have been pedaling reverse squares. Because he was shivering so aggressively that there's no way he would have had control of that bike or his legs well enough to pedal them. So he would have been dropped from the group a long, long time before. There was no prospect of him trying to come back. There's a big monument at the weekend. What's the point?
Mm.
Why are you out there as long as you are? So it seems like the decision to remove riders from the race is delayed for far, far, far too long when things do go wrong.
Yeah. I mean, cyclists, you know, are well known for going through some pretty tough conditions. I mean, certainly professional riders, I think, can overcome an incredible amount of stuff. So when you see that happening, you realize that it is pretty extreme, because you wouldn't see that normally. A pro cyclist will ride pretty much through anything just to get the win. And there were some dramatic scenes from that. Anyway, so let's move on to our final topic of the day today. And this, Gareth, I'm going to ask you to explain this a bit, because this is a story that's obviously been on our discourse channel, where this is around the Chinese swimmers. And maybe you can just give us a bit of background as to what people have been discussing it and to the story itself.
Yeah, well, it came up earlier this week, and I'm sure people have seen it in the media already, that 23 Chinese swimmers have tested positive for a banned heart drug, TMZ. They tested positive actually back in 2021. And we've only started to hear about it now, which is part of the issue. Apparently, they were contaminated in a hotel restaurant that they were all in, where they all somehow ingested this drug. But the real story is that, like I say, nobody's heard of it until now. And it took a little bit of whistleblowing and a German documentary team to really go into it, along with, I think, the New York Times. And one of the big problems is that several of these Chinese swimmers went on to win medals in Tokyo, including three gold medals. So, of course, there's been uproar throughout the media about it. And USADA have got involved. Travis Tygart, the head of USADA, the US anti-doping, has really been questioning WADA on its policies, because WADA basically said they were informed about this by CHINADA. It's all these acronyms are great, aren't they? CHINADA, which is the Chinese anti-doping, they were informed about it, looked at it, and they were sort of advised by their legal teams that there was no way they were going to win any sort of appeal against the decision by CAS, because basically CHINADA turned around and said, okay, we believe that these 23 athletes were inadvertently contaminated, and so there's no case to be had. And WADA said, fine, fair enough. And then it all went silent until this whistleblower has appeared and all hell's broken loose. So now we've got WADA threatening to take Travis Tygart to court, I think was the last thing we heard about it. In fact, they've just today, I think it was, Ross, did a press conference, an hour-long press conference about it all. So it's all a bit murky. And to say that people on Discourse are skeptical about the Chinese athletes in the first place, because really there's two sides to this story. You've got the actual doping case itself. Were these Chinese swimmers doping, or were they innocent of this heart drug which found its way into their food or in the air or however it was done? And the second part is, why is there no transparency from WADA? Because I believe the WADA rules are that once there's a doping case, then there's a provisional suspension of the athletes while it's investigated, and then it's publicly, the story is publicly released by WADA, which clearly didn't happen in this case. So it's all very convoluted. And of course, now it's turned into a bit of a pile-on with, I think you've got German athletics getting involved. I think FINA are involved. And basically, WADA's, I think, a bit on the back foot at the minute, I think it's fair to say. So that's the summary. It's very convoluted at the moment. And this is, when the story first came up, I was sort of up in arms and a little bit hyperbolic about it, perhaps on Discourse. And I think it was Peter McNerney came back and said, well, what else could you expect WADA to do? And that's a really reasonable thing to say, because WADA's hands were tied at this point. So and Ross said, well, perhaps the problem is that I used the word nebulous, but really it's the problem is that WADA are sort of behest to their each country's own doping agencies. So it's a bit nebulous. It's nobody seems to really be in total control of the whole thing, which appears to be heading off the roads and careering downhill at the minute. So that's my 2-minute take on Chinese doping in a nutshell.
Yeah, Ross, before I bring you in, just to give you the background then. So ARD, the German TV channel, and the New York Times led this investigation, and they looked through a 61-page investigative report that was done by the Chinese anti-doping agency. And they discovered that they'd found trace elements of TMZ in the extractor fan, on the spice containers, and the drains of the hotel kitchen where the swimmers had been staying, which is the justification for it. So as Gareth has just said, you obviously have to take the word of the drug authority in that country and say, well, are they compromised in that finding, or are they legitimately innocent of doping?
Yes. Now, there's a lot to the story. The WADA doesn't always take the word of its national anti-doping organizations, its member federations. And that's why you often hear WADA will appeal the decision made by the Spanish anti-doping agency, whoever it is, the Italian, the South African. It's happened here as well, where SAIDS, our institute, we don't have an ADA, we have an AIDS, South African Institute of Drug Free Sport. They'll clear an athlete and then WADA will appeal that. They chose not to because they didn't feel that they had enough to win the case. And so it was just going to be a black hole for money and time and energy. So the fundamental problem is this, like you're publishing two magazines, yeah, Mike, I'm talking about now.
Yes.
So you're ultimately accountable for bringing those magazines out on the schedule that's agreed with the title owner. So you are accountable. But imagine you had to produce the content for those magazines from 25 different people who all had to get things to you on time and so forth, and they never did. And you had no way to force them to do it. That's the situation Waters in. They are accountable without having power.
Yeah.
And so the dilemma for them when a story like this comes out is if they came out and said, you know what, we heard about this, but we couldn't get into China to investigate it because of COVID. We can't challenge what Chanada have concluded based on their report.
Chanada is the Chinese anti-doping authority. Right. Yeah.
We can't challenge them. We have to take their word for it. That would be a confession of lacking power. And so they don't want to do that because that looks not, that's not so cool. So instead they say, we've looked at it. And then this is where it gets convoluted. We've looked at TMZ and we find no benefits for performance. We've looked at the concentration of the drugs in the athlete's urine that was detected, and it's so low that it supports contamination and wouldn't be performance enhancing. That's totally off script. And so they're in effect supporting the and justifying the conclusion made by Chanada in order to appear as though they've got some some influence over it. The reality is that because of COVID, they couldn't get in there and they couldn't do the investigations for themselves. And so they're in a really difficult situation because the way it's set up, as Gareth has alluded to, is they are reliant on people on the ground to do the work the right way. And in the absence of the ability to test whether that work was done the right way, they kind of have to accept it. Or they could say, for the sake of posturing, we're challenging Chanada, but that's politically and financially and time-wise, maybe quite unfavorable for them to do. So that's why, in the end, they don't tell us anything. So for example, TMZ is a drug, trimetrazine is its name.
It's a hot drug, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's not the first time we've seen it because Kamila Velieva, who's the young Russian ice skater, who was the big story of the Winter Olympics in 2022, that was the drug she was caught with. So that's the one case. And then a Chinese swimmer called Sun Yang, who's a famous and controversial swimmer because at the last Olympics, a number of the Australian swimmers and other countries failed to or refused to shake his hand and recognize him because he'd failed the test for the same drug. So whatever's going on in the East, and by East I mean Russia and China, this drug is in circulation.
Mm.
And so they're claiming contamination. Cool, maybe that's the case because maybe the cook at the hotel is an older guy who's been given this drug for heart conditions.
Mm.
But now you've got to explain why 23 athletes failed. There were 200 athletes in that hotel. Were they not exposed if it was in the extractor fan? It seems like a kind of place you'd find it if it was pretty widely.
And it's a tablet and not a powder.
And it's a tablet. So how did it get? So like those are some of the questions that you'd have to explore if you wanted to do a thorough investigation.
Yeah.
Now, Chanada, from all accounts, haven't done a thorough investigation and WADA haven't been able to do a thorough investigation. So now it's a take our word for it situation.
Yeah.
And WADA can't flex to say we're challenging this regardless because they would lose that in court.
Yeah.
And so they're backing out of a fight they know they can't win. So you feel actually some sympathy for them, but no sympathy on the transparency side because you should actually just come out and say these things.
Well, they do kind of. In that Guardian story, they talk about it said it had not been possible for its scientists or investigators to conduct inquiries on the ground in China, given the extreme restrictions in place due to COVID, which you've already mentioned.
Mm.
But then there is further support from World Athletics, who said they believe the tests were handled diligently and professionally. So there's support unequivocally from World Aquatics, saying that, yeah, which supports the fact that they felt the test was done properly. So they're not questioning the Chinese doping authority, World Aquatics. Although WADA are not necessarily saying that they totally trusted, they just said they couldn't do due diligence around. So,
is there a world? Is there a world championships or a big event due to go to China anytime soon?
I don't know, Gareth. Any idea on that one?
No idea. You're being as cynical as I am now, Ross. Perhaps.
Well, there's no doubt that there's a political pressure. You know, if you're bidding or planning to host a big event, then as that organizing, I mean, that was the case for Russia.
Mm.
I think that's a big part of it, you know. And Russia and China are the two of the big three, right? Other than the US.
Mm.
It's interesting to me that the US gets involved the way that it does because it's taken the role of global police on this issue and is quite happy to flex against the East, but invites huge risk, I think, because, okay, whilst I don't know that there'd be state-sponsored doping in the US, You can't guarantee your own house is in order.
No.
Before you start flinging accusations at others.
What are your thoughts on that? I mean, when you look at the evidence, Russ, I mean, do you look at it with skepticism?
Yeah, of course, because, you know, 23 out of 200, low concentrations. Now we have to swallow this idea that low concentrations means contamination. Mm. No, of course not. Could mean you took a high dose a week before you were tested, or a low dose the night before you were tested. But you see, there are ways that WADA could build that argument, and so could Janada, by the way. If you've tested that athlete six times over 2 weeks, and you find constantly low doses, and some days it's there, some days it's not, that supports maybe a low exposure argument, right?
Mm.
If you've only got one test in each of those 23 athletes, then low concentration's irrelevant. I don't even know why it's being raised and put on the table. Whereas if you've got some, and of the other, 177 athletes, like, did they not have any? Were they not tested? Did some of them get tested and found to be negative? It's the same exercise. Remember when COVID hit and everyone was doing those exercises to see, could we trace the super spreader event? And you say, these people tended to congregate together. They all got sick. These people didn't. None of them got. That's the kind of epidemiological doping exercise that would maybe support that argument. Now, did Chinada do it? Maybe not. WADA couldn't. Mm-hmm. But at least what WADA could do is say, well, this is what we would have done. We couldn't. Well, this is what Chinada did. Here it is. You know, like, so some transparency and, dare I say, humility about our own limitations. Because, yes, WADA have said they couldn't get in there. And I'm sympathetic to that because of COVID.
Mm.
But they haven't said anything like enough to convince me that Chinada's 61 pages is worth believing at face value.
Mm-hmm. So I guess it's interesting. Yeah, sorry, Gareth.
No, I was going to say, I forgot to mention a story that was on the Associated Press. I think yesterday it came up that in the last 2 years before WADA signed off on clearing the 23 athletes, that China had contributed nearly $2 million above its yearly requirements to WADA programs. So they gave $993,000 in 2018 and $992,000 in 2019. In 2 years, it led to one of its Olympians being elected to one of the agency's vice presidents. So, yeah, it does sound a little bit sketchy there. And it does go on to mention the fraying tensions between the United States and WADA. And I was going to bring it up, Ross. Do you remember the calf sleeves story that came up? We were going to mention about this one.
Yeah.
Because we talk about everybody, and you've got to be careful because you can't just assume that one country's good, one country's bad, because you just can't. The world doesn't work that way. And USADA certainly isn't as Snow White in all these things as you would believe, because an Owen Zarelli posted a really interesting post on Discord about calf sleeve contamination in athletics. So there was a Aldrich Bailey of Texas was tested positive for trace levels of osterine from contaminated neoprene hamstring sleeves at no fault of his own.
That's the compression ones.
So he did not face a period of ineligibility, has no fault violation, but nevertheless, it must be publicly disclosed with disqualification of competitive routes if neglected, blah, blah, blah. So basically, Travis Tygart then says, basically, through in-depth investigations and painstaking scientific studies, we continue to see the way many athletes may be innocently exposed to prohibited substances. Now, that's coming from the head of USADA, because it's an American athlete who basically, I think he borrowed his mate's hamstring sleeves and his mate was using this drug. So he tested positive, but then got away with it, while his mate actually went down for it, I think is the...
So you're saying Travis Tygart actually was defending this?
And then defended this.
Which is kind of ironic, given his not defending, like, on a, certainly very critical of the Chinese situation.
I reckon on a scale of, like, highly believable to, like, what the hell are you talking about? This calf sleeve thing is further over to the what the hell side than the Chinese TMZ explanation.
Perfect.
Is.
Yeah.
But so
you see, both could be true, or neither could be true. You don't know.
Mm.
And in fact, the broader context to this is that USADA, for at least the last 5 or 6 years, has been on quite an aggressive push to change the doping code so that very small doses of banned substances are not declared to be doping.
Yeah.
Because they are saying, and I can see why, they're saying that the risk of contamination to athletes is so high and the consequence of that contamination is so enormous to the athletes and to the sport, actually, because they continually drag sport through the mud, that I think USADA are almost leaning in that direction that the NFL and Major League Baseball have gone with respect to doping, which is to say, let's not look too hard for it. It's actually a net negative for us. Mm. So Travis Tygart's got form for backing anything that supports contamination at very low concentrations. Let's let it go.
He's supporting that.
Yeah.
He's totally against.
Yeah.
So in other words, what you're saying, unless it's Chinese.
Correct. That's the problem. And that's why I made the point, and Gareth's reinforcing the point, is that you have to be real careful when you say, your explanation is nonsense, but here, let me show you mine. And they're actually the same thing. Mm. So, because if it's low levels of a drug, and you're going to argue that it's at such low levels that it A, supports contamination, and B, is highly unlikely to be performance enhancing, then that must be equally true whether it's TMZ in China or Austrine in the USA.
Yeah.
You can't now say, you Chinese, we're super suspicious of you lot, and therefore we don't believe contamination for you, but we're going to let our guys off.
Yeah.
That's the problem that they've got. And I don't know, that whole low dose of low concentration thing is a separate debate maybe, but
Travis Tygart is an interesting character because he was the one that chased down Lance Armstrong to some extent, wasn't he?
Mm.
So exactly. He's got a history of being, quite one of the sort of celebrity anti-dopers. Anyway, that's pretty much wraps it up for this episode of our Discourse catch-up. Big thank you to Gareth for putting together a lot of our notes on this episode, and of course to Professor Ross Tucker, who's heading off to Europe this evening. What are you doing in Europe other than riding? I think you're riding your bike a bit, aren't you?
I'm going to squeeze in a couple of days in Belgium and re-explore the cobbles.
Right. Take videos.
I'll try. It's hard enough to keep the bike going with two hands on the bars.
Put the GoPro on the side of the trail, then go down and ride up again so we can see how you handle it.
So that's a couple of days, but mostly it's meetings, World Rugby Medical meetings, and then there's a Court of Arbitration for Sport hearing that I'm attending, which will be in the news, I'm sure, in the next 2 weeks. When I get back, I can talk about it, but not now.
It's a big one, yeah.
And then we go to New York with World Rugby to meet with the NFL, because as you know, we've got shared concussion challenges. And so we're going to meet with them when we can to discuss what we're doing and learn about what they're doing so that we can benefit from the shared knowledge. Yeah, so it's like a fairly lengthy trip and busy.
Gareth, just give us a quick heads up on to the topics of discussion on our Discourse channel today. What can people look forward to if you look at our sort of top threads on Discourse today?
There's an interesting one which we were going to touch on. I think Ross promised he was going to touch on it, but we haven't had time this morning, about the differences between cycling and running, or transitioning from running to cycling, rather. So that'll have to be one for another day. Apologies to Alistair, who we never got around to that one. And then there's a few other things. We've been talking, as you say, about the taper. We've been talking about whether or not the reported carbohydrate values on certain energy gels are actually legitimate. Like I say, there's always so much stuff going on there that it's just looking down it now, I'm thinking, oh, look, there's people posting while I'm reading this. So, yeah.
So don't forget, get involved. Get involved if you're interested in the world of science and sport. So that's the place to be on our Discourse channel. But for now, for us, it's goodbye.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
You have been listening to the Science of Sport podcast. Follow us on X, Facebook, Instagram, and join the conversation on our exclusive Science of Sport Patreon page.